This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and five specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. Service providers and volunteers in Chicago are scrambling to find shelter and warm clothes for people without a place to live. That includes thousands of migrants, some of them sleeping in makeshift tents outside of police stations as temperatures drop. It also includes people experiencing homelessness. It's clear Chicago has a housing problem. And it makes us wonder, how did we get here? Who is this impacting? And what will fix the problem? So let's explore those questions with Bob Palmer, Policy Director for Housing Action Illinois, a nonprofit working to end homelessness and expand affordable housing. And Roderick Wilson, the Executive Director of Lugenia Burns Hope Center in Bronzeville. Rod started off by talking us through the differences between affordable, public, and low-income housing.
First, when it comes to affordable housing, it's a catch-all phrase. It just means anything that's not market rate. So it's not a set thing. You have low-income housing tax credits that could be considered affordable housing. Now, first, I want to define affordability means you're only paying 30% of your income towards your housing cost, your rent. That means it's affordable to you across the board. Now, say you're in a low-income housing tax credit building. That's based off the 60% AMI. AMI, I think, is $110,000. 60% is around $66,000. So you're paying 30% of the income of someone who makes $66,000. You necessarily may not be making that 60% income, of AMI. You might not be making that $66,000. You may be making $40,000, but you're still paying 30% of that $66,000. So it's not affordable for you. Or you come in making it, and then the affordability goes up. I mean, the income guidelines go up.
Yeah.
But your income doesn't.
When you say AMI, you're talking about the area median income.
That's right. Which includes more than Chicago proper. It includes the surrounding areas, it's higher than what Chicago median income is.
Yeah.
But so you could be in one, and then over the years end up paying 40, 50, 60% of your income toward rent, but they would consider it affordable housing because it's not market rate. Public housing is federally funded housing. And you have public housing developments, which are the standalones. You have a project-based Section 8. And then in those, you're paying 30% of your income no matter what your income is. So if your income goes down, then what you pay goes down. If it goes up, what you pay goes up. Got so it. That's real affordable housing. But even we have another thing in Chicago, the ARO ordinance, the Affordable Requirements Ordinance, passed late 2000s. And it said that, say you a developer buys some land, and they want in a zone for 6 units, but they want to build 100 units on it. Because they got to get the zoning changed, it's an inclusionary zoning ordinance. Because they got to get the zoning changed, then the city can require them to pay to make 10% of that affordable housing.
Yeah, okay.
But that affordability is based, it's supposed to go up to 60% of the AMI. Of course, everybody went 60% of the AMI. If you made 50%, you weren't getting in. 40%, 30%, 20%, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So it always went to the high end because everything is market-driven. So we have changed that to make it certain percentages have to be 60, certain have to be 30%, certain have to be 50%. So we include more folks who need housing because if I have a full-time job at $15 an hour, which is almost twice the federal minimum wage, I make $28,000 a year. I'm not even at 30% AMI.
Yeah.
So I could be working full time and I can't afford what considered affordable housing in Chicago.
And that right there is the issue. Bob, let's bring you in. When we say Chicago is experiencing a housing crisis, What types of housing are we talking about? Is it a crisis then of all the types of housing that Rod just broke down for us?
Well, you were asking about the overall problem and kind of the roots of that. So, you know, in our society, including in the Chicago area, most people get their housing from the private market. And if your income is at a certain level, then that works fairly well for you. But if you look at, you know, homeownership, affordable rental housing, particularly for people with the lowest incomes, the private market just doesn't work. The costs that are involved in maintaining and operating apartments are such in terms of, you know, paying property taxes, making sure the electricity is on, paying for the heat and so forth. It's really, really challenging to charge rents that are affordable to people with the lowest incomes. So if you look at who has the most severe housing problems in our society, and at least in terms of rental housing or people experiencing homelessness, it's really those people in the extremely low income category. And overall in Illinois, there's a shortage of about 300,000 rental units for people in that extremely low income category. And that's mostly all in the Chicago metro area.
So when we talk about housing issues, are problems renting and owning different?
Well, it's relative to your situation. Again, affordable housing, it's all totally relative.
Yeah.
You know, if you're earning.
I think you were focused there on home ownership. So I want to make sure.
Well,
that
I did make a quick mention of home ownership, but the numbers I quoted were on rental housing. But, you know, affordable housing is a really general term for somebody who earns, you know, $300,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
There's something out there that's affordable to them. There's certain housing that isn't affordable to them, but they can get their needs met in the private market very easily. But for those extremely low income households, again, those are the people who are renters that for the most part, 3/4 of extremely low income renters are paying more than 50% of their income for housing across the state. It's very much the same in the Chicago metro area. And essentially in our society, housing is a competitive thing. And if you have adequate income, you're going to be able to afford housing. But
right.
If your income is not adequate, you're kind of out of luck in this competition, which is why it's so important that we have the type of public resources that Rod was talking about, public housing, housing choice vouchers,
mm-hmm.
low-income housing tax credits to create the housing that the private market is not creating on its own.
Rod, many advocates say it's the high cost of housing as well as the lack of affordable housing that leads one to homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
What's your response to folks who say being homeless is either one, a personal failure,
mm-hmm.
or two, it's a result of someone's addiction or mental health condition?
I think those are just ignorant statements. Who doesn't know what people are going through? I think so. The thing about homelessness is, again, it goes back to everything is market driven. Everything is based on how much money someone can make on it. Again, like I said, I could be working 40 hours a week and I could be homeless because I can't afford an affordable housing unit, meaning that it is affordable, not market rate. Because if I'm making $15 an hour, I'm making $2,400 a month. The average two-bedroom in Chicago is, what, $1,700? So if I'm making $2,400 grossing, I'm only bringing home about maybe two. So is 90% of my income supposed to go toward housing? So I think there's this thing when it comes to people who are low income, who may be in these situations, we see them a certain way. But that's a society. And I think that's also, to me, it's part of the threat of racism that cuts through the society, that we don't recognize housing should be a right for everyone. And it's on government to make sure that that's the case. And right now, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
Government works for typically the business class and typically for industry, not as much for people. There's a thing that, you know, we've been advocating for the ban, lifting the ban on rent control, which would cost the state nothing. And then you can begin to regulate how much a landlord can raise their income. Right now, a landlord can double your rent, triple your rent from lease to lease. And that's not right. That's not fair. That's not anything. So what we're saying is people come into communities 3 to 5 years and then they got to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And they got to go. So how can you build community? How can you develop roots? How can you get to know your neighbors? How can you be, how can the community be safe if it's constantly moving based off of how greedy and price gouging that happens. Not all landlords do this, but we do see a lot of it, especially when in gentrifying communities.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that later in the discussion. I want to back us up a little bit, Bob. Mm-hmm. How did we get here? You know, Rod brings up some great points. I'm also thinking about redlining in Chicago, mm-hmm. right? You know, that practice of denying eligible or creditworthy people services like loans or insurance benefits just based off of where they live and because they're seen as this, quote, financial risk, right? So, I mean, talk about redlining and how that's impacted just the kinds of housing options that are available to folks, especially Black people in Chicago.
Well, yes, and redlining, again, going back to homeownership, you know, is particularly harmful in terms of limiting people's access to mortgages and restricting where people could live. But there, if we were to go back to focusing on rental housing, an example of another type of public policy that has largely had negative impacts is zoning, and particularly in Illinois, but this is true all around the country, that local governments can make decisions about what type of housing they will and will not allow in their community. So, for example, in many suburbs of Chicago, it's very difficult to have any apartment buildings mm-hmm. or even, again, for homeownership, requirements about lot sizes and minimum setbacks mean that you can only really build big, expensive housing, and you can't build, you know, homes that would be affordable to first-time home buyers or people of more moderate means. Even in many communities, and this is true in parts of Chicago, you know, you can't build a two or three or four flat. And so we know these are very sensitive issues because of that I think are tied to unfair conceptions about affordable housing. And for some people, when they think about affordable housing, they just think about, well, that means public housing. But really, it's much broader than that. And affordable housing is something that everyone needs. It's a basic human need. And again, we should be treating our society housing as a basic human right. Mm-hmm. But instead, we're, again, and the private market, again, works well for many people. But if we just leave housing to the private market, a lot of people are going to be left out. And that's exactly why we have homelessness today.
Yeah, and so you're touching there on policy that continues to make housing an issue.
Right.
You know, we've also seen numerous housing projects like Cabrini Green, the Robert Taylor homes, demolished in the 90s and early 2000s. They were home to thousands of Chicagoans, right? Fast forward, now we're seeing this trend of building mixed-income housing. How's that going, Rod?
It's not going well at all. I mean, because when they started demolishing the public housing, there was this promise they were going to bring back a fraction of the housing that was there. Only a fraction was supposed to come back. So what ended up happening is that fraction that was, they're bringing back a fraction of a fraction of that. So at the Harold Ickes home, you had 100,000 units of public housing. They started building back some of the units. They're saying they're only going to bring back 240 units of the public housing that was there. They built about 80 units. At the Abler home, you had 3,596 units of public housing. Only 750 of the public housing units supposed to come back. They built 245, and then under the Lightfoot administration, decided to give 25 acres of vacant land to a billionaire that owns Chicago Fire soccer team to build a training facility and soccer fields. At Robert Taylor home, you had 4,400 units of public housing, 800 units supposed to come back. They built about 350, 400 units, and they gave a block of land to a program called Excess Tennis without building back the housing. So it's not going good because what we were promised, the small amount we were promised, we haven't been given back. And the problem with this is that we see development as the geography of a particular area, the neighborhood. We don't see it as the community, the people. If we saw development, we need to change that paradigm. How do we make the existing population's quality of life better? Then we'll do it differently. Because our organization advocated when they first came up with the plans transformation, let's not get rid of all the public houses at once. Let's tear down a building, build some housing, bring the people back, then go to the next building. So you don't lose people. Mm-hmm. People who are there could benefit from it. They didn't do that. For the first time in history, they gave people Section 8 vouchers. They would just hand them in public housing, and now you can use them outside of Chicago. So what ended up happening was it was a public-funded depopulation of black people out of Chicago. And people went to Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana, Wisconsin, and those folks ain't came back. And yeah. So we lost 300,000 people, went from 52% of the population to 28%, mainly because of the plan for transformation, directly, indirectly, those directly for those families there and indirectly for the black folks yeah. who lived in those communities who could not afford to live there once the public housing left.
What's the plan for the people who have been here this
right.
entire time?
It has to be focused on the folks that's there, not let's bring in the Starbucks, let's bring in the Whole Foods, the thing that they can't afford
yeah.
that makes the community look better, but it's not improving the quality of life for the people that's there now, because then you'll be putting different things within the community.
Bob, as I mentioned here, we're seeing these two realities. In Chicago, we've got neighborhoods with too little investment, and then we got these so-called hot neighborhoods where rents and home prices have gone up fast, and it's forcing some longtime residents out. That can feel like two extremes. I wonder what you make of it.
Well, yes, it is two extremes, and I think the cause of that is, again, the fact that the housing market again, primarily relying on the private market in our situation, we set up this competition for the, you know, the housing that people want to live in based on, you know, what the housing looks like, the quality of the housing, is it close to public transportation, is it close to shopping? And because there's this overall shortage, when a neighborhood becomes more attractive, when it's more affordable, then more and more people want to go there, and all of a sudden it's not affordable, mm-hmm. or over years it becomes not affordable, and mm-hmm. people wind up getting displaced. And, you know, the housing market reflects kind of the problems in our society with systemic racial and economic mm-hmm. inequality. And so in this competitive market, you know, again, it supports people who are very much disproportionately people of color mm-hmm. who wind up losing. So we really need to change the paradigm that we have for housing in our society, that it is a basic human right, and that yeah. we need the public resources to make sure that everyone can afford it.
I want to go back to something Rod brought up earlier, and it's a focus on renting.
Mm-hmm.
Let me hear from both of you briefly on this. Mm-hmm. Tell us more, Rod, about the role that you think landlords play in this crisis.
I think, you know, landlords, especially those larger conglomerates, those larger landlords, they are price gouging folks. And as we've seen that. We've seen it in Brownsville. We've seen it in Pilsen. We've seen it in Logan Square. You know, they want to clear out a building. They'll double, triple the rent, push people out, and then they bring in a different gentry, a different demographic into the community. Even after COVID, we saw 12, 13, 14, 15% increases in rent. And, you know, folks' income didn't go up, but they can do it because no one regulates them. And I think that's the thing that we have to really get control of, because rent should not just be at the whim of whatever someone thinks they can get from it. I mean, I know we live in a capitalist society. I get that. But that doesn't help the people. The people, especially the most vulnerable, but those who are working full time mm-hmm. and still can't afford to live there. And that's where the role of government comes in. Government has to work for all the people, not just those who are in business, not just those who are landowners or landlords and that type of thing. But sometimes those low-income working families get left out because they can't contribute to a campaign, whereas landlords and the real estate lobby can. And so those elected officials then lend their policy to them instead of the people that they're supposed to be serving.
Right. Well, here's the thing. We've talked quite a bit with landlords here on, mm-hmm. on Reset and renters. When I talk to landlords, though, many of them say, Bob, that inflation's been a major issue for them in the mm-hmm. last few years, and they've got no choice but to pass on some of those costs to their renters, and they say that they're just beholden to market forces just like everybody else. What do you think?
I think there is quite a bit of truth in that. Obviously, there's a lot of different landlords. You can find all different kinds of perspectives and so forth. But, you know, in terms of solutions, one important resource that comes from the federal government is the Housing Choice Voucher Program. And in Illinois, about 95,000 households are able to afford their rent through a Housing Choice Voucher. But we know nationally, only about 1 in 4 households that would income qualify for a Housing Choice Voucher are able to get it. In the Chicago area, pretty much at every housing authority, all the waiting lists are closed. You have to wait, you know, a decade or more if you're fortunate enough to be on the waiting list to get a voucher. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that would be an example in terms of helping people to be able to pay the rent to increase the number of housing choice vouchers. But then on the other side, we need to be increasing the housing stock so that there are more there's more choice, more resources, more affordable apartments available to everyone. And that's actually something that both for-profit and nonprofit landlords can participate in through programs like the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program from the federal government,
yeah,
or a variety of other housing production programs that are out there.
I'm going to add another voice to the conversation. Mm-hmm. That's Antonio Gutierrez, who works on strategic development and operations as co-founder of Organizing Communities Against Deportation. They're also co-founder of the Autonomous Tenants Union. Welcome, Antonio.
Hi, everybody. Good morning.
Tell us about the work that the Autonomous Tenants Union does when it comes to organizing renters and the biggest issues that you're seeing right now.
Yes. So over the last 6 years since ATU started, we have seen how undocumented immigrants specifically really have a lot of issues when accessing housing, from credit reports that are requested at the application process, from having a form of ID, or even like a steady income or a social security number, which many of these things undocumented immigrants do not have. So ultimately, right, the crisis that we're dealing right now at hand has been going on for decades, and it has been very unfair to undocumented immigrants overall.
Your organization is a neighborhood. Well, actually, let me get Rod's take here. I wonder what goes through your mind when you hear about issues that the city is having also housing asylum seekers.
I think, you know, when we saw under the Lightfoot administration, we saw that the city turned on a dime to begin to build housing for migrants who come in who desperately need housing. But there's also a population of folks who've been in Chicago that needed housing. And we never seen the city turn a dime for those folks like that, which says, you know, a brother of mine, G2 Braun, always says budgets are based on priority. You know, because the migrant issue was a nationally publicized issue, there was this prioritization of it. All the thousands of homeless folks in Chicago who were sleeping in tents on the side of the expressway or just couch surfing from home to home.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't get that same type of response over the last generations, you know. So this issue, you know, with migrants, I think we have not to see it as a migrant issue, but as a housing issue and a homeless issue. So that we look at getting these resources for all of those that need housing, not just prioritize a group that's coming because they need housing. And this, you know, we just did an event with an organization that hopes is a part of United Congress, a community of religious organizations, looking at some of the core reasons why the migrant issue has happened. Mm-hmm. And it's based off of U.S. policies that have destabilized Venezuela, the same kind of policies that we have in our community, in the black community, that destabilized us. So we can't see them as like, we can't list them against us. No, this is a homeless issue. This is a housing issue across the board. And we need all the resources to help us get to this issue, you know, to be able to deal with this issue. But it has to be across the board for everybody.
Yeah. Antonio, let's piggyback off that here. I want to mention that you are co-founder of the Albany Park Defense Network. Albany Park's a neighborhood on the northwest side with lots of different immigrant groups who speak many different languages. We know that this housing crisis is impacting new arrivals, to Rod's point. Talk more about what you see as the intersections here.
Yes, of course. So, yes, I have lived in Albany Park, one of the most diverse neighborhoods, for about 10 years now. And overall, ultimately, what we have seen, right, is that there is instability around housing for many groups of people in the city. And right now, what is happening with the influx of the recently arrived, like, asylum seekers, right, is that it's highlighting a lot of those inaccuracies and also lack of affordable housing. As Bob was mentioning, overall, right? Immigrants in general, whenever they don't have a legal status to stay in this country, they're not able to benefit out of, for example, the Chicago Housing Authority, housing voucher. They don't have access to public housing. And so they're always at risk of imminent eviction. Mm-hmm. We actually have supported many tenants where mass eviction occurs after a new owner buys a building that was kind of organically affordable most of the times because of the conditions that exist in those buildings, right? People not have dignified apartments, but regardless of that being inexpensive enough for them to afford it, then a new owner comes in, evicts everybody, and then increases the rent to any amount that they want or that the market will allow it, increasing the price for everybody else in the neighborhood as well.
Yeah.
And of course, decreasing the amount of stock of affordable housing that we have in the city, which the city is also not creating on its own, right? Mm-hmm. So when you take out, subtract housing through those methods that are allowed through this capitalist like system, and you're not creating any, of course, there's going to be a shortage of housing that is only going to be highlighted when you have an influx of so many new individuals coming to our communities,
right,
which we're seeing at the process, right, of people having to stay at the police stations, having to influx and increase the amount of shelter beds that we have. But ultimately, we believe that increasing the number of beds in shelters, we have seen that has not solved the housing crisis that we have dealt for decades in the city. On the contrary, it increases the notion, right, that if you don't have access to housing, it's because you have done something wrong, because of how we see housing as a commodity and not a human right.
Right. Sasha, can I add one thing? The same priority we're giving housing now for, you know, the migrant community, if we would have did that 5 years ago for the homeless population, 10, 15, 20 years ago, we would be in a different place now. We would be able to handle this a lot differently. But it wasn't a priority. It wasn't important. I think whenever there's a challenge, there's an opportunity. And I think for the city of Chicago, there's an opportunity to say we need to house everyone so that, you know, we would have been in a different place. We would have the system set up. We wouldn't have to be dealing with two different type of homeless populations either. We could have been dealing with just that. But I think the issue has been, it's never been a value on those who have been unhoused and homeless in the city of Chicago, because they're not affluent. You know, they're not maybe meeting with their alderman or someone else. They're like a hidden population that's within the city, that we need to make sure that everyone gets what they need to thrive in the city of Chicago, not just some folks.
So Bob, let's continue looking forward, right? We're struggling with temporary housing solutions at the moment. Mm-hmm. How do we even begin to think about permanent housing solutions? Does it require a big shift in the way that we are thinking about this?
It does require a big shift, but there are lots of great existing programs and policies that are helping improve the problem, although it's still obviously very bad and there's this huge shortage. I mentioned housing choice vouchers. The federal government is really crucially important in providing resources, but Governor Pritzker has done some very good things in terms of increasing investments in the Home Illinois state plan to prevent and end homelessness. We're very excited that the Bring Chicago Home Chicago ordinance to create more resources through the making the real estate transfer tax progressive seems to be moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, for example, just one thing, a new funding opportunity that's available through the Biden administration that the local regional area agency for planning is applying for, in addition to the city of Chicago and some other communities, that will provide some financial resources for communities to look and try and address how maybe zoning in their community is an obstacle to creating more affordable housing.
Yeah.
And so hopefully those applications will get funded.
As we continue our discussion around Chicago's housing crisis, we also have to look forward. What needs to change to fix our housing woes? Erica Pothig is Executive Vice President for Strategy and Planning for the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club of Chicago. That group works with leaders around the city to promote social and economic change in areas from public safety to education to technology. And Erica was formerly a special assistant to President Joe Biden for housing and urban policy on the White House Domestic Policy Council. And she started off by weighing in on what we've discussed so far.
Something I wanted to add for context is And I think Bob said this earlier. Only one quarter of the people who are eligible for the affordable housing resources, the federal housing resources, receive them. So housing is a lottery. And that is stands in contrast to some of the other basic needs that people need met in this country, like healthcare, which is an entitlement. So one of the things that we all face around the country in the United States is affordable housing is an under-resourced need and has been for decades. And that's been true. It is usually also a family's largest expense. So when a family pays more for housing because their rent has increased, well, that's crowding out another investment, maybe in their kids' education, maybe in their ability to get to work. So that's why we also need Congress to act, and we can get into this, on some of the kinds of policies that can help address the housing affordability challenges in Chicago and elsewhere. Something else I just would add to this, looking at it from a national perspective, is, and this may be challenging, and my colleagues here may disagree, but when you look around the country, Chicago's affordability, housing affordability, is actually one of its assets. We've talked about relative, you know, housing affordability is a relative concept to someone's income. Well, Chicago is actually relatively more affordable than some of the larger cities on the coast. And so when we look at homelessness, for instance, we have a challenge in Chicago, but we are also have been for decades addressing homelessness in a more proactive way than some of our other like-sized cities.
So you're talking about like New York or L.A.?
New York, L.A., Seattle, San Francisco. And there's a professor from the University of Washington, Greg Coburn, who wrote this great book called Homelessness is a Housing Problem. And he looked at Chicago because Chicago actually has a relatively lower rate of homelessness than some of the other cities of its equivalent size. And that's because Chicago and the state of Illinois have taken steps to provide more options using state, local, federal resources to proactively address homelessness.
So let's dig into some of those things. Let's go back to the federal level. Tell me what's happening right now to address this problem. And then we'll get into Illinois and Chicago.
So obviously COVID has been a major challenge. But in the American Rescue Plan, there were significant resources allocated to addressing housing, not the least of which was more than $50 billion for emergency rental assistance to make sure that people were not evicted from their homes and did not become homeless. That is a historic number of resources. There was also about $10 billion allocated to address homelessness through the Emergency Housing Voucher Program and through something called HOME, which can invest in permanent supportive housing options to address homelessness. So together, these were historic resources that have been allocated at the federal level. But over the last few budget cycles, President Biden has also asked Congress to increase the rental assistance. So we talked about housing choice vouchers. On the campaign, he wanted to make sure that all those who are eligible, the three quarters of people who aren't receiving rental assistance today, would receive it. So that involves making a request to Congress to increase the number of housing vouchers. So in the last number of budgets, he's asked for 200,000 additional vouchers. Congress has, up until this point, allocated resources for 35,000 additional vouchers. Okay. We heard Bob say there are 90,000. You know, Illinois and Chicago get some share of that rental assistance. That's a major request. And making it an entitlement for kids aging out of foster care and for extremely low-income veterans. These are some of the proposals that the administration has put on the table for Congress's consideration.
I see. You've said before that it was policy that created these problems, Erica. So is it more policy that's the solution to fixing this?
Yeah. So one thing that I want to name, and you've named it, and Bob and Robert Roderick have named it, is one of the challenges facing Chicago is the racial segregation that was frankly created via policy through redlining. for instance. And the Federal Home Housing Administration at HUD contributed to that redlining. And so that is policy that created the conditions that we face today because of people's constrained opportunity and the under-resourced and under-invested neighborhoods that were resulted. Policy is going to have to reverse that, too. And that comes through budgetary investments like the ones I described, but also some other important policy like the Community Reinvestment Act.
What's that?
That is, so, and I would just name Gail Sincotta, who is a Chicago organizer, legendary in the city, but in the country. And she led a movement here in Chicago and nationally to raise attention to the practice of redlining, which, you know, was banks essentially saying we will not lend in these neighborhoods.
Right.
The Community Reinvestment Act is a set of requirements and regulations that the those that regulate the you know, large banks and community banks have to follow to make sure that where they're taking deposits is also where they're lending resources. The Federal Reserve Bank, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the FDIC, all just last week or 2 weeks ago published a new updated modernized Community Reinvestment Act regulation that will ensure that banks are being held accountable to making sure they're making investments in neighborhoods that have been traditionally underinvested in.
So we've been talking about how there are these two dynamics, two sides when it comes to the affordability of housing, right? I'm talking about income and then the price of housing. So talk more about policy that you you think could address both sides, the price side of the issue and then the income side, and whether you think it's possible at all to fix housing issues without addressing both.
Yeah, no, you have to address both for sure. Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about the supply side of this. So at the federal level in March 2022, the Biden administration put out a housing supply action plan because Bob pointed out earlier that supply is one of the challenges that we face. When we don't have enough supply of affordable housing, prices will rise. It's constrained, right?
Right.
So we need to increase supply. Across the country, we are 1.5 million units short of enough housing. And that is also true here in Chicago, especially for extremely low-income people. And part of the solution is the supply. So there has been on the table for Congress's consideration increasing the resources to increase the supply, like the low-income housing tax credit as an example. So we need more federal investments to increase the supply of housing. That's up for Congress right now to decide whether to make make that policy.
Okay.
On the income side, you know, one of the challenges is it costs too much to build housing than people can afford. We've talked about this. Roderick talked about the share of people's income. It just doesn't pencil out. And so one of the ways we pencil it out is through supply side subsidies that help bring down the cost of what it takes to build, but also rental assistance, which fills in the gap between what it costs to operate housing and what someone can afford. Right.
So those vouchers we talked about.
Those vouchers are that form of rental assistance that helps fill in that gap. We can also increase income. So one of the things that was also part of the American Rescue Plan was the child tax credit. We know that the child tax credit cut poverty, childhood poverty, by 50%. That is an income supplement. And that we know people use some of that for paying for their housing, whether it was to supplement existing subsidy or to fill in the gaps, because as we've said, only one quarter of the people who are eligible for affordable housing resources get them. So those other three quarters may have used that to pay for their housing.
Going back to our discussion earlier, we got to address that the issue of housing, it's different when we're talking about renting versus owning, right? So what do you think is important to keep in mind about these two different things when it comes to solutions?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, we have this is true for Chicago, it's around the country, we have a gap between Black and brown households that are homeowners and white households. So we have a part of the racial wealth gap is associated with the gap we face in homeownership access. So one of the things we have to do is we have to be ensuring that we are providing access to capital to low, moderate income Americans, but also thinking about how to do this in more equitable ways so that people can get opportunities to become homeowners. In Chicago, one of the ways folks have built their wealth is by purchasing 2 to 4 unit properties. And Bob talked about that is an incredibly important part of Chicago's rental housing supply. It represents something like 35% of Chicago's rental stock are in 2 to 4 unit buildings. Well, 50% of those 2 to 4 unit buildings are owner occupied. And they're oftentimes owned by Black and brown homeowners who are then renting out that housing. So it's like it's an important way to ways in which homeownership and rental housing interact. But we've lost a lot of those 2 to 4 unit buildings, which is, I think, contributing to the housing affordability challenges that we're facing. So one of the things we have to do is we have to shore up those 2 to 4 unit properties by focusing on foreclosure prevention to keep those homeowners in place who are the providers of rental housing, but also look for ways to bring new kinds of capital through community development financial institutions, CDFIs, like Community Investment Corporation, CIC, who are helping to finance some of those kind of 2 to 4 unit properties, which are an essential supply of rental housing, especially unsubsidized rental housing.
On the program yesterday, Erica, we talked about rising property tax bills. Mm-hmm. Perfect timing. We got homeowners who were calling in, and some were saying they've left. I remember a woman called from Indiana, said she left years ago. Other folks were saying they're considering leaving Cook County just because of the fact that their bills have increased substantially. They simply can't afford it anymore. One caller also asked about an alternative to the property tax system. Is there a way to pay for services like public schools without raising people's property taxes?
So every state or city can decide how to finance what revenues they choose to finance their services. And we rely heavily in Illinois and in Chicago on the property tax system to be able to do that. And property taxes are paid by commercial property owners, businesses, as well as homeowners. And there's been an effort to make sure that there's a more balanced and fair system through the assessment. But one of the challenges in the last couple of years has been that the value of commercial properties has declined as people are not using those office spaces in the same kind of ways. We've seen a lot of stories about the downtown vacancies. And so that shows up then in the burdens that people are paying for, through their property taxes. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I would say we need to focus on is how to make sure that we have a healthy central business district instead of commercial properties that are also contributing to the tax base in the city. So last week, for instance, the White House had rolled out a new set of policies focused on supporting the conversion of commercial properties to residential properties. Many of these are in the downtown area, like LaSalle Street, for instance, and making less than market rate financing available to support the kinds of development that would be next to transit and supply affordable housing. We need to take those kinds of steps too to shore up some of the kinds of assets that are contributing to that tax base so that we can afford the services that are important to our city.
Yeah.
But it is today true that we rely heavily upon the property tax for financing services.
I want to make good use of the last 2 minutes I have with you, Erica. First up, Chicago City Council, they're going to meet today, most likely with a vote to put the Bring Chicago Home ordinance on the March primary ballot. And I want to be clear to folks listening that this is not going to be a vote to put it in action, just to have it on the ballot as a referendum question. Now, that ordinance, Bring Chicago Home, it's going to raise the city's tax rate, if approved, on properties that are sold for over $1 million. It would also lower tax rates on properties sold less than that. And the money would be used to help fund homeless services. Are you in agreement of that approach? concerns?
We, as the Civic Committee, have not taken a position on that policy. So Erica Pothig thinks that, and you heard me say earlier, affordable housing is an under-resourced part of what is an important platform for people's livelihood. At the same time, I think it's really, really critical that we have a good plan mm-hmm. always.
You think there's a better way to do this?
A better way to raise money? Mm-hmm. Or I think that those alternatives are worth debating. But it is, you know, one source of income. I think the challenge with the real estate transfer tax is it's a very lumpy tax and very dependent upon transactions. If you're going to fund affordable housing services through that tax, I think you have to be very careful about what your commitments you're making because you can't rely upon a steady source every year.
We'll leave it there. We've been talking with Erica Pothig of the Civic Community of the Commercial Club of Chicago. Thank you so much, Erica.
Yeah, thank you.
This episode was produced by Micah Yason and edited by Dan Tucker and Brenda Ruiz. If you liked this conversation, we host interviews every day about the issues most impacting the Chicago area. You can find our entire catalog of interviews at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you so much for listening. We'll meet again tomorrow.